From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, connecting with the spirit world, and we've got an amazing program for you tonight. Here's what's happening. China is building nuke warheads at an accelerating pace and will have at least 1,000 by the end of the decade, according to the Pentagon's new China report released after a two-month delay. It's also unlikely, they say, that China will make some kind of move on Taiwan within the next 2 years, according to U.S. officials. The comments came amid heightened tension in the region and U.S. reassurances that it would stand with Taiwan against Chinese aggression. We assign Howard Bloom, author of The Global Brain, on this story. Howard, I'm not sure. I think China's got some eyes on Taiwan. What do you think?
Oh, you bet. Fox News reports that Chief of Staff Mark Milley, the head of our military, told the Aspen Security Forum today that it's unlikely China will try to move on Taiwan in the next 2 years, which means we have 2 years of breathing room before we have to fear a war with China over Taiwan. Right? Wrong. China is prepared to wipe out our aircraft, navy, and military bases in Japan and Guam with a new Pearl Harbor. First off, China has a military branch we lack, a rocket force. That rocket force has 100,000 men and what the U.S. Department of Defense calls the largest and most diverse arsenal of missiles in the world. China has apparently been practicing with its rockets in the Gobi Desert for at least 6 years. What is it practicing? A new Pearl Harbor. First, the rocket brigade would launch a salvo of penetrating rockets to take out airfield runways, aircraft shelters, and semi-underground fuel tanks. According to Thomas Shugart of the Center for a New American Security, that first salvo would also take out our air defenses and command centers, killing all our command people, and crater the runways of military air bases, making it impossible for our fighter jets to take off. Then would come precision-guided ballistic missiles. These would be followed by a wave of cruise missiles and planes to target hardened aircraft shelters, aircraft parked in the open, and fuel handling and maintenance facilities. On top of all that are the carrier killer ballistic missiles China has built specifically to reduce our 12 aircraft carriers to smoldering heaps of steel from a distance of, get this, 3,200 miles. But say some analysts, after these attacks, China does not have the landing craft to bring its troops to Taiwan. And the lack of landing craft, these analysts explain, means that China does not intend to take Taiwan by force anytime in the immediate future. But that's not true. China has a civilian fleet of at least 63 commercial ferries plying the South China Sea, the Yellow Sea, and the Bohai Gulf. Some of them are three times the size of any ferries ever seen in North America. By Chinese law, these ferries have been built for both civilian and for military use. They can carry tanks, armored cars, and 1,200 men at a time to Taiwan's beaches. All of this will soon be backed by what the Pentagon revealed today, that China intends to have 1,000 nuclear warheads by 2030. And if you need anything else to rattle you, according to China's business publication, Caixin Global, China's Commerce Ministry told local authorities on Monday to encourage households to keep certain stocks of daily necessities like meat and vegetables in case of any emergency.
Oh boy.
What emergency is the Commerce Ministry anticipating? Could it be this? Chinese tactics call for strikes that hit us when we least expect them. The Chinese call this active defense. And in Chinese doctrine, a surprise attack is justified by anything that threatens China's territorial integrity or sovereignty. In China's eyes, we threaten Chinese territorial integrity and sovereignty every time we make a statement supporting Taiwan, every time we sell a weapon to Taiwan, and every time we send a naval vessel into the Taiwan Straits. Some military experts believe that China would prefer to take Taiwan peacefully through a long, slow campaign of intimidation. And flashing its military might is one way that over time China can wear us down. But in reality, when it comes to Taiwan, Xi Jinping can switch to the military option any time he wants.
Let's watch what happens on this one, Howard. Thank you so much. Zillow Group, their shares plunged as investors digested the news that the company was pulling the plug on its high-tech powered home flipping operation. Now, the stock dropped almost 16%. The home flipping halt raised major questions about what's next for a company that was pushing deeper into the U.S. housing market as part of its bid to transform itself from an online listings giant into a buyer and seller of thousands of homes a month. Michael Shedlock, registered investment advisor with us. Mish, this seems to be an important story. What's going on here?
It's quite amusing to me. When I wrote about this on my blog, and I called it the hoot of the day, it's pretty amazing here, George. Zillow managed to lose money in a market in which home prices have gone up at a record pace for four consecutive months. Home prices have gone up every month this year, and they managed to lose money. And their statement is pretty amazing here, George. We've determined the unpredictability in forecasting home prices far exceeded what we anticipated. What? Home prices went up, George. You know, what was it they didn't anticipate? George, my first question here is, what does that say about Zillow's estimates of what they think homes are worth?
Good point.
Not very good, right?
Good point.
The second news story of the day is the Fed. They met today, and allegedly they're on autopilot. As anticipated, they came out and they said they're going to taper at $10 billion a month. And if they do that, then they will end tapering by June of next year. They've also said they anticipate hiking at that time, and they've penciled in two rate hikes. In other words, George, they are on autopilot for the next 12 months. Yes. George, I don't believe that. I doubt that you believe that. People can't predict these things. In fact, people can't even predict home prices when they're going up.
Watch what happens on their next Wednesday meeting.
Let's see what happens at Christmas with retail sales and the economy, as we've discussed the last couple times I've been on, is slowing rapidly. I don't think the Fed is going to finish with this tapering and get in all those rate hikes.
You've been spot on lately, so thank you, Mish. Breaking up is often an unpleasant experience for both people in a relationship. While stereotypes typically paint women as the more emotional partner in any couple, a new study finds that's not the case when couples fall apart. Researchers from Lancaster University in the United Kingdom say men appear to experience more emotional pain and heartbreak when a relationship ends. In a moment, a name you hear a lot on this program, Robert Bigelow, joins us. We're going to talk about his latest venture, the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies. He's seeking proof on life after death. That's one of the stories we'll talk with him about on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Lately, when you hear the name is Skinwalker Ranch, UFOs, you hear the name Robert Bigelow attached to that. Well, we've got him as our special guest tonight, thanks to our colleague George Knapp. Robert Bigelow graduated from Arizona State University with a Bachelor of Science degree in Business Administration, and back in 1999, he founded Bigelow Aerospace, general contracting investment research and development company that concentrates on achieving economic breakthroughs and the cost associated with design, development, and construction of habitable space stations, space transportation, launch facilities as well. Robert is active and a member of various businesses, scientific, and community organizations. Robert, welcome to the program. This is an honor to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, George, and the honor's all mine.
And George Knapp thinks the world of you, and we think the world of him.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He really is.
He really is. I wanted to talk a little bit, before we get into your new venture, to talk about you and your interests. I mean, when you were a little boy, were you interested in UFOs and extraterrestrial life?
Yeah, I was. I grew up in a very unusual environment. I was born in 1944, and so in the 1950s, Las Vegas was a very small town, and it was very unusual. Because we had Nellis Air Force Base right out our back door, and there weren't the restrictions on breaking the sound barrier, so we had jets breaking the sound barrier all the time, and windows would crack and so forth. But the exciting thing was to really watch the atomic bombs go off, and those were above-ground tests. There were about 700 and some tests over the years, both underground and above ground. And so they started out above ground, of course, and they were about 10 to 12 kilotons and then up to 150 kilotons. And at nighttime, it lit up the sky like daylight. And in the daytime, we would be let out in the schoolyard, and we would see the mushroom cloud. We were about 75 miles from ground zero.
Oh, geez.
So we would see the mushroom clouds rise to maybe 30,000 feet or so. And we'd see the cloud first, and then you would hear a rumble because the earth would shake. So it's a bomb-created earthquake. And that was a sequence of events, and the cloud always preceded the shaking of the earth. And it might be around a 3 on a Richter scale for the larger ones. So that was kind of a fun time. But the interest in UFOs occurred because I had friends whose parents had seen things at close hand and didn't find out about those stories until I was older. But then the main impetus of my curiosity began with my own the story of my grandparents of an encounter that they had, and I heard that story from my mother, and my grandfather and my grandmother wouldn't talk about it too much. So that was the genesis of my curiosity.
And it grew and grew and grew. And you have been really at the forefront of investigations. You purchased the Skinwalker Ranch, which is a very strange, strange place. And but you've been a very successful businessman, which has allowed you to grow with your ventures. You started Budget Suites, which are apartment, almost like apartment hotels, aren't they? Where they've got kitchens in there and everything else, don't they?
They do. We function as an innkeeper by law in the states that the properties are in, and for the first 30 days, and then we're a landlord for the extended stay of the customer, and they may stay for many years, maybe 15 years or more, in the same apartment.
I remember when we first started hearing your name associated with space and space travel, you wanted, and you still do, you want to build a space hotel. You've got some modules up there already, don't you?
Yeah, we still do. Thanks to the Russians, I purchased some NEPRs, some SS-18s back in 2007, and we launched Genesis 1, and then we launched Genesis 2. And we were allowed to stay overnight for a few nights on a military base, and we were probably within a mile and a half or so from the actual silo that launched those payloads.
And then, of course, back several years ago, you were able to urge former Senator Harry Reid from Nevada to push and initiate the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, which is a government study which operated for several years studying the UFOs. How much convincing did that take?
Well, Senator Reid had attended a few of our meetings that we had and with NIDS, and I had a very adept science advisory board of terrific folks, and we undertook two branches of study. One was the ET study, and the other was the survival of consciousness study, and both of those fields were so huge that it became clear to us as a group that we need to choose, and so we chose the ET area, mm-hmm. and Senator Reid was in on those discussions, and he was impressed by all the presentations, and then, of course, the coup de grace was Jim Lukasky. And there's a new book out of Jim Lukasky's Skinwalkers at the Pentagon, also co-authored by George and Colin Kelleher.
Yeah.
And it was because of a phone call that I got from Jim that started that thing, that ball going, and then I got a letter from him, and and so then I brought in Senator Reid and showed him, what I had received and told him about the conversations and so on that the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, was actually stepping out of the shadows, out of the closet, and they were coming clean. And here you had a large intelligence operation of the federal government not just admitting that there was an interest, but they were actually going to encourage the focus of that investigation and encourage the funding of that. So Senator Reid, being so well connected as he was in those years, along with Senator Stevens and Senator Inouye, between the three of them, they essentially control black budgets, and so they were able to maneuver successfully to arrange for those funds.
What's your gut tell you, Bob, about the possibility of UFOs and ETs? I got to believe that you believe, like we do, that they're out there and they've been coming here.
Well, in doing my field research, first thing I did is read 50 or 60 books in order to be able to talk the talk and know what people were discussing when they mentioned certain cases in certain parts of the country or other countries. And so I had to have a modicum of competency. So when I first began, that's what I did. I read about 50 or 60 books in about a year's time, so I could at least do that. I personally interviewed, sometimes using a tape recorder or taking notes on a legal pad, about 230 people or so, face-to-face. And sometimes they would say, now, I haven't told anybody what I'm about to tell you, so turn off your tape recorder. So I did those. I also conducted field research on cattle mutilations. I sponsored many different people, including deans of colleges, to investigate crop circles in England and other places. And then I bought a couple of ranches for living laboratories,
mm-hmm.
and the most famous one was the Skinwalker Ranch. So that investigative process lasted for a lot of years and was taken very seriously by me and with the people with whom I worked, because I had the pleasure of working with world-class researchers like Jacques Vallée and other folks, and I wouldn't trade that for anything. That was so much fun. It's not even possible for me to try to describe it.
And you are really, I think, the only person on the planet who's dedicating your own personal funds in such a big way to get to the bottom of these incredible, incredible stories. And I have to congratulate you on having the guts to do that, because obviously there's no return here. You're not going to make a lot of money on it, but you're going to get some answers.
Well, it's a function of of having a passion, and return is the return is a different kind. So it isn't a monetary return, and of course you have to have one foot anchored in the world that produces a living and produces financial capabilities. So you have to have balance, while the other foot is feeling around different kinds of paths and trying to determine the potentiality of different ways of pursuing a quest. And so that's what I did for decades, and always maintained business interests in banking and real estate and construction. And I built 15,000 apartments that I owned and operated, and I purchased another 8,000 from other people. I bought interest in banks and was a member of board of directors of a couple different banks. So that was my part of my business world. And the voyages into, as a voyeur, into ET and consciousness studies and even aerospace, none of those brought back financial returns of any kind, but what they did was give me a sense of feeling of really trying to understand things that are not perhaps even understandable, such as the ET phenomena, and because it's so deep and so strange, and I thought it could not be surpassed, and I never was bothered or afraid or anything like that, but I was always in awe, and still am, over that subject. But I became astounded that I would think that anything else could maybe match it or surpass it. And that's what the consciousness study, survival consciousness study field, potentially offers. And that's saying a mouthful. That is saying really quite something when you can try to compare the two and even have the audacity to say that one exceeds the other.
Robert, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about your new venture, the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies, where you plan to give out $1.8 million for proof about the afterlife. It's a contest. I'll have you explain what that is as well. Our special guest tonight, Robert Bigelow. We'll take calls with Robert next hour here on Coast to Coast. His website is linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. And this is truly a remarkable, incredible story that we will have for you. And Robert Bigelow has been a well-known name on this program for a long, long time. Back in a moment with him on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take calls with Robert Bigelow next hour here on Coast to Coast. When we come back with him, we'll be talking about his latest venture, the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies. It's an amazing idea and program. We'll get right into that. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with Robert Bigelow. Robert, were you disappointed in the June 25th report that the government kicked out about the UAPs?
I think a lot of times there's a lack of information, and for whatever reasons, you know, it's not revealed. And I think
right.
There's a posturing that sometimes goes on. So that kind of thing is not a surprise.
Are you sometimes given information that that has not been released yet publicly, for whatever reason you've got to hold back? I mean, do you know something about what's going on up there?
Oh, of course. Sure.
I knew it. Would it shock us if we really knew the story?
Yes, some of it would. Some of it you already are aware of hardware. You're aware of that. You've had many people, especially George Knapp, and talking about that. But there's other things that I think they would surprise folks.
I'll ask you one more question on this, then we'll get into your new venture. The alien abduction phenomena that is happening, I think it's widespread. I think it's happening more than people realize. And it might not be a very pleasant thing. Am I right?
Well, that's an area that that we researched extensively, and I've sat many times at the left hand of a practitioner who was regressing somebody, and I helped write notes and pass on questions and different things, so it's very real through multiple witnesses and things of that sort, but a lot of ways to establish proof. There is a sense that it has lessened significantly in the compared to times in the past when John Mack and Bud Hopkins and others and myself were really into trying to explore that. So there is a sense that that has fluctuated and changed. The phenomena seems to go through patterns of evolution, and even though we have the drone-type vehicles sort of off the east and west coasts, we don't have the displays that are so blatant as the Phoenix Lights of 1997, and that was actual craft because structure was able to be seen, not just lights, because it entered the northern part of the state, and so many tens of thousands of people saw that structure. So it wasn't just a matter of, you know, lights just hanging there, much less flares, but it was lights that were definitely attached to structure, a boomerang type of structure. So those kinds of blatant exhibitions have kind of evolved, and it's kind of curious speculating as to, well, what comes next, because cattle mutilations are not as prolific. They still continue, but they're not as prolific as they were. Abductions are not as prolific as they were. And other kinds of exhibitions, and, of course, the crashes seem to happen in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, but we haven't had any recent crashes that I know of, you know, in the last 10 years or 15 years. So there are changes that happen.
There really are. I mean, in the old days, the Hynek days, we used to hear stories of landing pod burns and things like that. We don't get that anymore.
Yeah, that's right. It's more covert. It's not as overt, I think, as historically it has been. So, for example, our missile silos are not visited routinely by UFO craft hovering overhead and shutting down 10 out of 10 missiles in one pod and 9 out of 10 of another, with all of them individually controlled electronically. Boeing established those systems, and they were. Then the same thing happened, of course, as you know, in Russia. And so that's about as blatant as you could possibly get, right into a government's face, and negate their ability to fire and launch those missiles. It can't get much more overt than that.
That's so true. Robert, you have formed the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, it's kind of picking up from where we had left off at NIDS. As I told you, we had to make a choice of the two branches, and the preponderance of the population of NIDS decided that, well, maybe ET was an easier task to go after. It was more evidentiary, and so this is kind of harboring back to harking back to that kind of era, only taking a more proactive approach, starting off with this contest. Like, if something like this has never been done before, certainly to this degree.
No, I've never heard of that. That's for sure.
Yeah, and so we're ecstatic that we acquired such a terrific response in 38 countries, and we have so many really great essays that came back to us. The best of the best of the best in the world from researchers have taken it upon themselves to go ahead and put into 25,000 words or less their best case. And the challenge was, you have to produce proof to the court of decision makers, to the court of objective thinkers, beyond a reasonable doubt to convict. And you're convicting. The challenge, the presentation to the court is that that the topic is real, the other side exists, and don't quote me chapter and verse on scripture. Anybody can do that.
Yep.
You have to have substantive proof that an open-minded, objective listener and viewer and reader would be able to judge and say, yep, you've made your case.
Have you made some awards at this point yet?
Yeah. Well, in terms of passing out the money?
Yeah.
No. I will be poor December the 4th because and that's when all the money is passed out virtually. And so, yes, I will be poor at that time and asking for handouts. And you, who knows, you know? But
we'll set up a GoFundMe for you if things go
right. Right. Yeah. And with both dollars, I'll buy you a hamburger someplace. Yeah. So we're having a nice party for maybe 90-ish people, and we'll have a DJ there. We'll have a lot of trophies, really nice trophies, and we're going to have, of course, the cashier's checks, and we'll have a lot of people on stage. And there are 29 winners, and some of the essays are co-authored, so we actually have 43 people that are going to be receiving checks of one kind or another.
That's truly magnificent and exciting for them because they love what they do. I mean, the people I've interviewed on this program, Robert, are dedicated people to try to get answers to the question about it. You know, is there life after death?
Oh, it's not just saying it's a passion is almost superficial. It's way beyond. They're so dedicated. These researchers are so dedicated, they're so knowledgeable, they have put their heart and soul and their life into these kinds of endeavors.
Where was your interest in this subject?
Well, I lost my father to an airplane crash when I was 18.
Oh, geez.
Lost one of my two sons when he was 25, I lost a grandson, my only grandson, when he was 20. And then I just lost a year and a half ago, 2 years, this February the 19th, my wife. We were married for 55 years.
Oh, gee, I'm sorry to hear that.
So I have a personal vested interest in whether or not the other side exists. And then just from an inquiring mind kind of standpoint, I think that you know, if you're an objective thinker and you have an open mind and you're willing to look at evidence and not just turn a blind eye and say, no, I'm going to take everything on a function of faith, pure faith. Okay, that's fine for some people. And some people may be totally agnostic or atheist, and that's fine too. Everybody can do their own thing and have their own choice. For me personally, that's not enough. I really want to know more, and I want to have concrete of information that is as concrete as you can possibly get, you know, within reason, and to say, yeah, I believe that that's true. And if that's so, then the next big question isn't just, okay, does whether or not the other side exists. They're really 98% of what's next, if you could ever do it, is what is the other side really all about?
Absolutely. I've had so many physicists on the program, Robert, and I ask them all the same question. Tell me about the Big Bang. What is it exactly? And they're all well-intentioned. They're all brains. But nobody can give me that answer that is acceptable to me of what happened. They really don't know. And I think with life after death, this life that we have here is so complicated and so unique and so special that there's got to be another extension to it. And I just have concluded without scientific data that there's more to just what we have on this life, this existence, that it carries forward into something very unusual and wonderful. I'm looking forward to seeing some of these essays once you publish them at the event.
Now, don't forget, the essay's mission is to convince you that the other side exists.
That's right.
Okay? So these particular essays, all of these essays, the 29 winners, do not get into the depth of what is it that the other side consists of, what is it all about. That's not their mission. That literature, there are probably hundreds of books that you can obtain that go into the research that people have done to try to get a feel to answer that particular kind of question.
That's true. Raymond Moody being one of them.
Yes. Yeah. There have been researchers going back for, a couple hundred years or more, you know, especially in the early 1800s and even in the 1700s. Swedenborg, there's been some terrific research that has been done many years ago. And today's scientists in the 21st century and even in the 20th century were so intimidated that we did not always get the best and the brightest to work in these esoteric areas.
That's absolutely true. With what you're hearing and seeing, and have you seen some of the essays now? Have they all been submitted?
They have all been submitted, and I'm doing my best to try to read as many as I can, and I will get through the 29 eventually. I will do that. And we are going to be publishing sets. We're going to compile all these 29 essays into a set of books, probably six or seven books into a set that are going to be leather-bound and embossed pages and ribbon and so forth, kind of like, you know, for collector's items. And we're going to pass those out freely, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 sets to hospices, to churches and to universities, and just to kind of try to get what these authors have gone to an awful lot of work to put together. We don't want this to be lost just because an essay was over. I mean, the contest was over with these essays. So just because the contest ends, I want to continue to publish several thousand of these sets and distribute those.
With what you've been reading so far, does it blow your mind?
What I've read so far is in harmony and within the context of what I've already read through an awful lot of literature, a lot of other books. So the compilation of these 29 essays would save you having to read maybe 50, 70 books.
Yeah.
You know, try to get to the conclusion that this is the other side is real. in order to get to what existence is the other side, are you able to have thought that does not need a container? So once the container decomposes, and once you no longer have a container, are you more than the sum of your parts? Can thought actually exist outside of a biological container? And the answer is yes. And then the answer is, well, what is the capabilities of that thought? And what if thoughts gang together? What if there is a communal process on the other side? So you have a coalition. And it doesn't mean just because you pass over that you become an archangel, you're going to morph into a terrifically kind, wonderful person, and you are just the opposite here on Earth. That is not what is represented in all the literature at all, and that is not the case. So it's that's just the tip of the iceberg. That is just the tip of the iceberg. It is enormously profound. The direction. So we're scratching our heads, literally at NIDS. We're saying, okay, what's next? What are we going to do in 22 and 23?
Mm-hmm.
Because we want to. Are we halfway between home base and first base, or are we halfway between third and home base?
That's right. You might not be able to stop.
I don't know. You know, your guess is as good as mine, George. I do not know.
Do any of the essays address the potential of miracles, Robert?
So what is a miracle? Is a miracle something that is performed by virtue of the power of prayer? And there have been blind and double-blind studies, a lot of them, that prove that the power of prayer does work.
Yes.
Okay, it does work.
No question about it.
Or if you have an object, if you have a glass that's full of water, and all of a sudden you see it slide across your desk, you see it slide across your table, and I'm talking about a real event here, and it actually happens, is that a miracle? Or was it a spirit on the other side that actually caused that to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, now it's transformed to where now you have an explanation, and it's not exactly a miracle, but it's something that's just unusual outside of our parochial physics. It's outside the parochial physics community, and so you say, well, no, it's not a miracle because we know that the other side exists and that they have significant powers and able to levitate things and move things. We've seen that happen.
Absolutely.
We know that's real.
Robert Hagen with us. We're at the top of the hour break. We'll come back and talk more about your incredible work. And also we'll take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.